overall view of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is divided into four major divisions. First, from experience, the preacher learned that man is powerless, a disappointing discovery. Chapter 1, verse 1 through 2:26. The second major division is from observation. The preacher learned that God has a design for all things. Chapter 3, 1 through 5:20. The third division is by application. The preacher found that the explanation for apparent inequities in divine providence, chapter 6, verse 1 through 8:15. And then the last division, in conclusion, the preacher determined to fear God, obey God, and enjoy life. And we, the last time I taught from Ecclesiastes, we finished the last section in the first division. From the experience, the preacher learned that man is powerless, a disappointing discovery. We learned that the content of Ecclesiastes was the words of the preacher, the son of David, so that the king of Israel. And so it was his teaching to the people, and the theme that he used was that all is vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And we looked at several different things that Solomon experienced in his life, and found that everything that he had considered was vanity or brevity. It faded away quickly. It didn't last long. Whether it was life under the sun, there's continual cycles. That the pursuit of wisdom in and of itself is vanity. If you're seeking wisdom to use it to live for God, that's one thing. And the life under the sun is basically trying to live life without God. And so a lot of the perspective that Solomon is bringing is if you try to live without God, things are meaningless, they're in vain, they fade away quickly. And that includes the pursuit of wisdom, the pursuit of pleasure, and life under the sun and labor under the sun all are resulting in vanity if you're trying to live your life without God. We're going to start a new division tonight. From observation, the preacher learned that God has a design for all things. In chapter 3, verses 1 through 22, and if you'll turn there, we're in Ecclesiastes, but in Ecclesiastes chapter 3. And I think rather than reading the whole chapter at once, we will read in sections. And I will read verses 1 through 8, and then we'll go through that before we go on to the next section. A time for everything. There is an appointed time for everything, and there is a time for every matter under heaven. A time to get birth and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to uproot what is planted. A time to kill, a time to heal. A time to tear down, a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn, a time to dance. A time to throw stones, a time to gather stones. A time to embrace, a time to shun embracing. A time to search and a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear apart and a time to sew together. A time to be silent and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. So the main structure of Ecclesiastes that we're using is I borrowed heavily from Dr. Barrick. He was a professor at Master's Seminary. And the major points are what he covers in his book. And I had done this as a home fellowship study. And so those things are primarily his. Some of the minor points I've organized and modified to have a good outline. And in this section, he talks about the hours, the days, and the years of our life, that those who are unbelievers have a tendency to try to control all their circumstances. And Solomon recognized that this is not possible. And they usually try to control their circumstances so they can either escape responsibilities or to seek to gain peace and security. And we'll look, first of all, at the poem's theme, A Time for Every Event, in verse 1. Now, Hebrew poetry has what they call a chiasm, and it's a Hebrew literary device that they use to keep things in order and to help you follow along. So they'll have a statement A, and then a statement B. Then they'll repeat statement B with just a little bit different wording, but the same meaning, and then they'll come back and do restatement of statement A. Same meaning, maybe a little bit different wording. So it goes A, B, restatement B, restatement A. Now, a more complex chiasm would be A, B, C, D, D restatement, C restatement, B restatement, A restatement. A and the restatement are parallel. The B and the B statement restatement are parallel. The C and C restatement are parallel. And the D and the D restatement are parallel. So here we have the first, more of a simple chiasm in verse 1. It says, there is an appointed time for everything. So the theme is time for every event. So everything that man faces in his life or undertakes or does on the earth, there is an appointed time. And then he restates that second statement and saying, and there is a time for every matter under heaven. So we have time, appointed time, everything, time for every matter. So it goes parallel. So the time and every matter are parallel, and the time and events. So you have everything and events parallel, every matter, and then the time are in the center, so that we have this chiasm. And the idea of time here is appointed time. And then the second time is a little bit different word, but it has an idea of a specific point within in a person's life or a season. So the point of time and the duration will be continued. So then the poem goes on, and we'll see different statements that are positive and some that are negative. In verse 2, we have a positive statement followed by a negative statement, a positive statement by a negative statement. In verse 7, which is parallel to that, you start with a negative statement, then a positive statement, a negative statement, then a positive statement. In the middle, there are four statements. In verses 3 and 4, there are four negative statements and four followed by four positive statements. In verses 5 and 6, it starts with four positive statements followed by four negative statements. And then verse 8 in the conclusion, it's a little bit different than verse 1. It goes positive, negative, negative, positive. So we'll go through these and consider briefly each of these. Now, our purpose on Wednesday night is not to have a detailed message, but more of a devotional and a survey of the passage. So in verse 2, it says a time to give birth, positive statement, a time to die, negative statement, a time to plant, positive statement, a time to uproot what is planted. So verses 2 and through 3, it controls the existence of things and versus non-existence. So we have a positive in verse 2, that of giving birth, starting life. The negative is dying. You end the physical existence of a person. Then there's a time for planting and then a time for uprooting. So if you want to try to grow food for yourself and others, you plant. You may have weeds that are growing up. You want to uproot those. And the result of that, pulling that weed up, is that the weed dies. And it might be that you're in a battle with another nation, and you don't want them to continue fighting on a long war, so you uproot their food so that they don't have anything to eat. So it's a complete tearing out of a plant. And then in verses 3 and 4, it goes then 4 negative statements, then 4 positive statements. A time for killing and a time for healing. When would be an appropriate time for killing? Well, if you're in a war, there's obviously going to be death that occurs. If you have someone committing a capital crime, the government needs to execute that person. So those are a couple examples that it is appropriate to kill life. And then a time for healing. And generally that's the case where we want to, if someone is sick or hurt, we want to bring healing to that individual. And then it says a time of tearing down and a time of building up. Example of a house. It may be so dilapidated that it's not worth trying to fix up, so you tear it completely down and then rebuild after that. Or a time to be building up and strengthening what's there, starting a new home for a new family. Then there's a time of weeping when we face grief within our life, whether it's death or sickness, a tragedy, an accident, or a house burns down, that brings occasion to express sorrow by weeping. And then the positive is the time to laugh, that we can, there's something that is funny, or there's joy, one to be expressed. Harvest is great. You have all your crops in, or you've gotten a promotion at work, and express that. And then a time of mourning and a time of dancing. Again, the weeping and mourning have ties to death or some serious condition, which brings about that weeping and mourning. And then laughing and dancing expresses a time of joy, of things that went well and that you're happy. So it went from 2 positive and 2 negative to 4 negative and 4 positive, and then it goes to 4 positive and then 4 negative. So he's working back and forth. So he goes 2, 4, 4, 2, and then he alternates the positive and negative statements. So in verses 5 and 6, we have the throwing away of stones and then the gathering of stones. Now, there's debate as to why throwing stones would be positive and gathering stones would be negative. You would think that you would gather stones out of the field so you could plant. But what they're saying is you're picking up and throwing the stones away from the field so that you can plant. Now, if you're in a war with another country, then you may want to pick up gather those stones and throw it in their field so they won't have food to eat. So that's the idea there, is that it's gathering to put into a field where the throwing stones is throwing the stones away from the field. And then there's a time for embracing, showing affection, and then there's a time to refrain from embracing, that it's not a proper time to show affection to another person. Then the positive, to search for something, and the negative, to give up searching. So you may have lost something and you want to continue looking for it, like the woman who lost a coin and swept her floor until she found it. Well, she may sweep that floor and sweep that floor and sweep that floor and never find it, and at some point she's going to say, I'm not going to find it. Or like when Elijah was taken up into heaven, Elijah said, don't go looking for him. He's been taken up to heaven. But the prophets said, or seers said, we need to search for him. So they searched for him for 2 or 3 days and never found him. And Elijah said, I told you not to go hunting because you won't find him. So there's a time when you need to give up searching for something. And then there's a time for keeping and a time for throwing away. So there are things that are of value that we want to get hold of. And there's other things that are really not worth holding on to. And there are some people like to hold on to things that really aren't worth holding on to. And then they get an elbow from the spouse. You really don't need that. So get rid of it. And then these contrast the limits of existence itself in 4 and 5. And so if there's death or tragedy, you weep and mourn. You throw stones on another person's, gather stones to throw on another person's field. And there's time for laughing and dancing and embracing. So they have contrasts here. And then in verse 7, it deals with, again, grief, sorrow. There is a time for tearing apart and a time for sewing together. And a lot of the examples in the Old Testament is when something bad happened, they would tear their clothes and it's showing grief. So when Joseph turned up missing, Reuben went to the well and he wasn't in the well. And he tore his clothes because he couldn't find his brother. And then when they brought the robe dipped in blood to his father Jacob, Jacob tore his clothes because he was under the assumption that his son had died. So the tearing of clothes was an indication that there was a time of grief. Sewing together indicated that the time of grief had ended, this time of sorrow, and you sewed back up your clothes and that time of grief was over. And then it's time of being silent, and we can look to Job. His three friends came, and for the first week, they didn't say anything because they saw in what pain he was in, and that was probably the best thing they did. Then they opened their mouths, and their counsel was not very uplifting for most of the rest of the book of Job. And then there was a time of speaking, which indicated joy. The grief was over, then you could talk. And then in verse 8, you have a positive, then a negative, then a negative, then a positive. So there's a time for loving and a time for hating, a time for making war and a time for making peace. So the loving and peace are parallel, and the hating and war are parallel. And so there are situations within our life that these are appropriate. And you shouldn't be hating somebody when you should be loving them. And then you shouldn't be making war if they haven't first attacked you. So the idea is to try to strive for peace within your life and to love others. and that there are situations in which you have Ukraine and Russia battling, where Russia invaded Ukraine, that the emotions that the Ukrainians feel is not love at that particular point, and that they had to protect their own nation, so they had to fight back in war. Then we'll look at the poem's message, and we'll take this in three parts. First of all, we'll look at verses 9 through 11. What advantage is there to the worker from that which he labors? I have seen the endeavor of which God has given to the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. He has made everything beautiful in its time, and he has also set eternity in their heart, yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning into the end. So I think the key verse in this chapter is he has made everything beautiful in its time. It has an appropriate time for each of these things. Going back under the poem's message, we see God's sovereignty or providence in all things. And first of all, concerning man's toil, apart from God, there is no gain in and of itself for toil. You are to work as unto God and not unto man. You do work to try to provide for yourself food and clothing and shelter. But if you're just working just to survive and you're not doing it for the glory of God, then in and of itself, it is not really a great advantage. Those that are working and with right motive and to seek to glorify God, then that toil will be rewarded. And then he said in verse 10, I have seen, again, this is pointing back to Solomon's observation. This is what he sees, have seen. I have seen the endeavor which God has given to the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. So that God has sovereignty over the circumstances that we face and works those out to for believers for their good, even though there might be bad things that happen along the way. He is using them in a positive means. And then concerning man's desire for eternity, it says in verse 11, he also set eternity in their heart. And so most people recognize intuitively that there's got to be more to this life than just the 50, 60, 70 years that we live on earth. There has to be something beyond. Unless you're an atheist, and then you would suppress that because you don't want to face any type of judgment. You live life, you die, and I don't have to worry about anything after that. I'm not going to face Creator's judgment because there is no God. So, and that's, I think, more of a wish than they suppress the truth that there is that emotion and the reality that there is something more to this life, after this life. And so God gives man a desire for eternity, and the things of time cannot fully satisfy man. It doesn't have permanent satisfaction in this life. There can be some joys, but we can't rest in just doing the activities of life and be happy with the whole thing, because it will come to an end. And then concerning man's knowledge of God's works in the latter part of 11, so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning to the end. We cannot fully understand all that God has done, is doing, will continue to do, even in the observation of nature. I saw a program that was dealing with animal life in the oceans, and they had gone down very deep to where it was completely dark. The pressure was be enough to crush most living life, but they were able to find various types of animal life even at the very bottom of that ocean, and that we cannot fully grasp everything that God has done, even within his creation on earth. There are things that we are continuing to learn, and we will never discover it all. God is sovereign over man's toil, his circumstances, his desire for eternity, and for the knowledge of God's work. In fact, it will take an eternity for believers to fully, probably never come to full recognition of who all God is and what he's done. And we do not have any idea of the things that God has planned for those who love him, that we will see in throughout eternity after this life. Then in verses 12 through 15, we see man's purpose. I know that there is nothing better for them than to be glad and to do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks and sees good in all his labor, it is a gift of God. I know everything that God does will be forever. There is nothing to add to it. There is nothing to take away from it. God has so worked that man should fear him. That which has been already and that which will be has already been, yet God seeks what is pursued. So we see that, first of all, the purpose of man in verse 12 is to be glad or to have joy. God desires that for his creation, his creatures. And that it says we are to rejoice always, pray without ceasing, and everything give thanks. So that is one of the purposes that God has for man, is to rejoice in what he has received. And then in contrast to what I have seen in verse 10, in verse 12 here it says, I know. And that's more of an intuitive knowledge, that he just knows that that's what is correct, not something that he had to learn. I know that... we are to do good in one's lifetime. And because God is holy and is righteous and just, we are to be holy, righteous, and just. So we are to do good while on earth and in this life. And then also in 13, moreover, that every man who eats and drinks and sees good in his labor, this is a gift of God, that we can have joy in what we do. And that working to provide so that we can sustain ourselves, physical life, to eat and drink, and then labor to provide that, that it, we should view that as good. And then in verses 14 and 15, it says that we should fear God. We know that everything God does will be forever. There's nothing to add to it or nothing to take away from it. God has so worked that men should fear him. That which has already been and that which will be has already been, yet God seeks what is pursued. So that the result is that we need to fear God. Again, it's I know. And in verse 14, so it's intuitive knowledge, not something that he has observed or learned by being taught, that we are to fear God. Everything he does remains forever. It says that God in Ephesians works everything according to the counsel of his will. So he fulfills his purpose within each individual that's ever lived, from Adam and Eve to the last person that is born. That he will accomplish what he desires and pleases, and there's nothing that we can do to change that. He works through his providence to bring that about. He works in our decisions, whether good or bad. And even when we do sin, it is accomplishing his overall will. And not that we are not responsible and accountable for everything that we do, and we will be rewarded, or if we're children of God, disciplined to correct us. And there's nothing that we can take away. We cannot force God to do something that's not part of his will, his sovereign will. We can break his moral will, but we can't do anything that would cause him not to fulfill his decree for mankind. So we can't take away from it. And that God is sovereign over our past and present and future. So that in verse 15, that which has been already and that which has already been or will be has already been, that it's established. God will bring that about. And he seeks what is pursued, and he desires relationship with mankind, and has made that possible through the work of his Son. And then verses 16 through 21, furthermore, I have seen under the sun that in the place of justice there is wickedness, and in the place of righteousness there is wickedness. I said in my heart, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man for a time for every matter and for every work there is. I said in my heart, concerning the sons of man, God is testing them in order to see that they are but beasts. For the fate of the sons of men and the fate of beasts are the same fate for each one. As one dies, so dies the other, and they fall, and they all have the same breath. So there is no advantage for man over beast, for all is vanity. All go to the same place, all come from dust and return to the dust. Who knows that the breath of man ascends upward and the breath of beasts descends downward? So then we first of all see man's justice, and there is much injustice in this life, that there is wickedness, and not everyone is caught or punished as they ought. But in God's justice, verses 17 through 21, God will judge the righteous man in every matter. And again, at the end of the book, he'll come to the conclusion. What is the conclusion? Is that we are to fear God and follow his commandments, for everyone will be have to give an account for all that he does, whether good or bad. And then God will judge the wicked in every deed. And that may not occur as soon as we would like it, and it may not even occur in this lifetime, but that wicked person will suffer the judgment that he deserves. And those that are righteous are those that have put their faith in him, in his Son, Jesus Christ, and their sins have been paid for. And then we are... our works are judged for either to be rewarded, or that if they are not in the right works, or they're sinful, or they're not done the right motivation, we lose reward for that. They are burned up. And then God tested man. I said in my heart, he's basically talking to himself and saying, this is his own thinking. And by observation, if we look and we see a person die and an animal die, can we observe the immaterial part of man going either to heaven or to hell at the point of death? We can't observe that. So he's just saying, from the perspective of just observing, there's no difference between a man and an animal. Although later, and this is basically Solomon being cynical in regarding to what he has observed as a human being trying to live or looking at it the perspective that there is no God. If that is true, then how do we know that an individual has life after death and an animal doesn't? We can't observe that. So then there in that this perspective, and that's what a lot of atheists believe, we're just an animal. We are born, we live, we die, and that's it. And so as far as they're concerned, there is no advantage of man over beast because we're just an animal like they are. By observation, no one knows if a man's breath or life force ascends upward and the beast descends downward, or that he just goes into the ground and disintegrates. So then he later on says, in chapter 12, verse 7, that the spirit does return to God after death. So he comes at the conclusion of the very end of the book that, yes, there is life after death. And when a man dies, his spirit goes back to God who had given it in the first place. Then finally in 22, he comes to this conclusion. I have seen, again, observation versus just knowledge, that nothing is better than that man should be glad in his works, for this is his portion. For who will bring him to see what will occur after him? The idea here is this is the lot that God has given to man. We should be happy in all of our activities, especially if we're doing that for him, to glorify his name. And then he says, for who will bring him to see what will occur after him? That is, after he dies, who's going to tell him before his death what's going to happen the hour after he dies, the day after he dies, the week after he dies, what's occurring on earth? No one can tell him that. No one can tell him exactly what history will take place once that person dies. He can't tell him before he dies that this is going to happen an hour, a day, a month, a year after he dies. This is what will happen when you're gone. No one can do that. The big summary here, I think, is that God has better things for us to do than to fret over things we can't control. And how often do we become anxious over those things that we cannot control? And or what if? Well, we don't know that what if will ever occur, but we get all excited. What if I get killed in a car accident tomorrow? Well, we can't stop that. And why get all upset about that? Well, I might get cancer. Well, that's beyond our control. And we're not to get upset about things that haven't even occurred. It may not ever occur. So some of the applications, and again, I have a number here, so what I would ask you to do is listen to what I'm saying, and if the Spirit is prompting you that this is something you need to keep in mind and to observe in your own life, that this is what is for you. Number one, timing is important. The activities of verses 2 through 8 are appropriate at certain times. The secret to peace with God is to discover, accept, and appreciate God's perfect timing. And we don't always like God's timing in our life. And so we need to have an attitude change in that regard. And when we become anxious and fearful, that certainly doesn't help us in our emotional being, and can even cause physical problems because of that turmoil. Number two, God is sovereign over man's circumstances. Nothing will occur that God has not already decreed that will happen. We can always say, well, I should have done this. I should have turned left instead of right, and I wouldn't have been in this accident. Well, it's happened. You couldn't control that. And God permitted that. Man's toil without God does not have much value. So if we're not working as unto God and for God, there's not a great deal of value in that. We have a yearning for eternity. Earthly pleasures will never fully satisfy because they end. Then you have to search for something else to take that place. And when that's over, then you need to search for something else to try to bring that pleasure. And that earthly pleasures will never fully satisfy in our life. 5, in this life we will not grasp all of God's works. We cannot comprehend why 7/11 took place. And all the people that it affected, from those in the towers to those in the planes to all the relatives of those who died and those that were spared. We don't understand why someone decided not to get on that plane that they were scheduled to be on, had tickets for, and didn't get on, and they were spared being killed. We can't comprehend all of that. We should rejoice, do good, eat, and see good in our labor and fear God. This is man's purpose. That's our purpose. Men may be unjust, but God is just and will bring into account all of man's actions at his appointed time. Sometimes not as soon as we'd like, but he does not forget anything. And everyone will be accountable for what they've done in this life. 8, unless we're raptured, our bodies will die. And 9, we should be happy in all of our activities. It may not be pleasant during that time, but if we have the strength to carry them out, we should be happy that we're able to do that. There are people that are disabled that can't do those activities. And then finally, and probably the second most after the one that God has better things for us to do than to fret over things we can't control, is that we need to trust God's word and not man's observation. And that includes Solomon's observation, that just because what we observe may not be what the reality is. And we need to trust God's word and not what other men say and observe.